Well, I think this Iranian conflict, many would agree, it's the bellwether military conflict of this decade. A lot of ramifications going forward. What history is behind it, I think, plays a part in it as well. We've learned a ton about it from Iranian-born University of Montana professor, Dr. Mehrdad Kia, right? Family there. They left in 1979 at the start of that Islamic revolution there. So some 50 years later, and the terrorist regime there has really not been touched. And it's just not a war on terror here. I think we've come to learn there are many players involved. China, Russia is involved in this. Venezuela, right? We talked a little bit about the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, and their involvement with all their assets. We're going to get a little bit deeper into that today with a guy who's been thinking about these things for a long time, Kenneth Abramowitz. He is the founder of Save the West and author of The Multi-Front War, Defending America from Political Islam, China, Russia, Pandemics, and Radical Strife, Racial Strife, and maybe some radical strife in there too, if that's not enough. We've got that today on Voices of Montana. Welcome our guest here today and really just kind of get into this. Our phone numbers are 866-627-5483 and then text a message at 781-627-5483. Kenneth Abramowitz, a venture capitalist, right? And as I just picked up his book, by the way, and learned early on in that, that he started thinking about national security kind of like what he had a 6-day work week, and then he decided, well, with everything's going on here, I'm going to have to think about some things about national security. Devoted one day a week, and then that turned into 2 days, and that eventually turned into this book, The Multi-Front War. I kind of think it's a multi-war front sometimes, too. That's, I'm saying it wrong, Kenneth. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Great. Very good. Thanks. Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I appreciate that. So, you know, back to the book, The Multi-Front War. I'm just kind of getting a piece of that. But there are so many actors involved well, not just this conflict, right? When you wrote this book originally in 2020, this was not on our, it might have been on our radar a little bit, but it was distance. But this book is about all these threats that America are facing. And one of your I think, notable quotes is that is, we're already in this war and we just don't know it. Or maybe we just don't want to, acknowledge it.
Yes, you're right. Democracies want to be happy. People want to go to their jobs. They want to make money. They want to pay their mortgage, build a family, go on vacation, do what normal people want to do. They don't wake up in the morning and say, "Oh, let's go to war with somebody. It's so much fun to blow somebody up." We don't think that way.
Right.
Now, the dictatorships, half the people in the world live in a dictatorship. The dictatorships wake up in the morning and the leaders say, "Okay, who can we blow up? What territory can we take over? Where is the area of least resistance? How can we destroy America? How can we destroy Israel?" So it's a basic difference of world outlook between democracies and dictatorships. So the key point is that dictatorships have declared war on the democracies, but the democracies haven't declared war on the dictatorships. And that's where we are right now.
Yeah, and I think we've noted and seen, tracked the detriment to us ignoring these threats. I mean, it's not that we don't know about them. It's that we are purposely ignoring them. Is that correct?
Yes, and it's endemic to all democracies. It's not just an America problem. So just pretend I'm running for president or senator or something, any office, and I say, "Vote for me. I'm going to take your tax dollars and I'm going to buy 2 more aircraft carriers, 100 more F-35 planes. I'm going to buy a lot of bombs. I'm going to hire more soldiers and we're going to fight this person, that country, this and this and this." And then the person I'm running against say, "Don't vote for that warmonger, Ken. Vote for me and I'm going to give you a subsidy for your children, your grandchildren, your house, your health care, your education." Well, who's going to win? Always the person promising subsidies, not me, until there's a war. And then when there's like 9/11, for example, then I get elected in this example, because people say, "Save me." Ken wants to save me. He wants to buy more aircraft carriers and planes. So this is endemic to democracy. It's typical of democracies of waiting until the bad guys attack. And then we get angry. And we say, we're not taking this. We're going to get these bastards. And then we fight. There's only one problem with that. In the military world, everything you want to fight with takes 3 to 5 years to buy. It's not like at Amazon, you know, you want to buy a book, you place an order today, and in 2 days or whatever, some book shows up. When you want an airplane, there's 5-year lag time, or a ship, 5 or 10 years, aircraft carriers, 10 years. So you can't wait till the war to order these things. You have to order them before. And so America has done that, and Israel has done it, not to as much as they should have, but they've done it. But the European countries, they're in la-la land. They weren't prepared. So basically, America and Israel are saving Western civilization. Yeah. America and Israel are saving democracy, and nobody else is really participating.
And sending notice, too, I think, to NATO. I mean, that was, in my mind, a really good part of the strategy. And there's so much more, to Kenneth Abramowitz here as well. He founded Save the West. It's a political commentary platform. It's focused on national security threats as well. Citizens for National Security, managing. And then you go back to kind of like a past life for you now, isn't it, Kenneth? A general manager of NGN Capital. So you're a healthcare venture capitalist. So you understand the dynamics here regarding all this. So this is why I'm really excited to have you on. I was just thinking about this the other day when Dr. Kia had informed us about the Revolutionary Guard having so many assets, a big part of the economy. And I was worried that how are we going to get regime change? Because I think that is the unspoken idea behind all of this without boots on the ground. I just didn't see it was going to happen without boots on the ground. But then I started thinking about how many assets this Iraqi, Revolutionary Guard has, and you hurt them in the pocketbooks instead of, putting boots on the ground, you might have success. I'm thinking that there's backroom negotiations going on, and I just saw a report that the IRGC has come out, and I think they kidnapped or at least sent a message to leadership about, hey, we are on this playing field. Do you think that this blockade, do you think with all that economic pressure that we can maybe accomplish regime change without boots on the ground?
Well, think of it as plan A and plan B. Plan A from President Trump was to basically blow them up, get regime change by blowing targets up. So in the past 40 days before the ceasefire, America and Israel each blew up something like 12,000, 13,000 targets, together roughly 25,000 targets. And President Trump publicly said, we have 3,000 more targets left, and it'll take another 2 weeks, give us patience. That was plan A. Then all of a sudden, he said, 2 weeks of ceasefire because the Strait of Hormuz had been closed, and Iran told me that they'll open the Strait of Hormuz if we have a ceasefire. So then we went to plan B, which was ceasefire and negotiate a surrender. And then that didn't work. So now we're in a quandary. Do we go to plan A, which is the military way, or to plan B, which is economic strangulation through a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz for Iran ships, not for anyone else. Everyone else can go through, but no Iranian ships, and blockade their oil and basically starve the country into submission. So that's plan B. So I would say to answer your question, it's some combination of plan A and B. Mm-hmm. In other words, some combination of military might, some element of negotiation, and some element of starvation, and you put it in a blender, and that's basically the recipe that President Trump is working on, trying to find a way to cause this regime to fall and have the people take over.
Do you think the IRGC,
or as we say, we the people take over?
Do you think the IRGC would cut ties with the terrorist regime. You know, they gave them $6 billion a year, I think, in a budget. And then they have all those assets. I mean, I don't know, anywhere like $50 billion. And now with Trump, you know, chipping away at those assets, are they talking to the IRGC separately from the terrorist regime?
Yeah, well, what seems to have happened is it was a religious theocracy run by some ayatollah. And then under that was the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was designed to protect the regime. Over the last few weeks, it sort of looks like the IRGC has taken over the country. So it's now running the country. Articles that I read say they own about 50% of the assets of the country. So think of it as an army plus a terror organization plus industrial conglomerate all mushed together, so to speak, and they seem to now be running the country. Now, from their point of view, they're a terror business and a real business at the same time.
Yeah.
And we've struck many of their assets, chemical plants, refineries, but it's like Nazi Germany. You can keep blowing them up, but they're not giving up till they're dead. So I hate to say this, but basically we have to keep bombing the leadership till they're dead. Because I don't know how to negotiate with people who are on a mission from Allah, their vision of God, to basically take over the Middle East and take over the world. I mean, this is a Looney Tune organization here. So I think that's why President Trump is so frustrated trying to work out a deal with basically second-generation Nazis.
And how do you? I think you have discussed this too. And we'll take a break here in about a minute and a half or so. How do you even negotiate with Iran when you know that everything they're telling you up front is misinformation? And everything they're going to agree to is essentially a lie, right? I mean, our administration knows that. What does negotiation accomplish?
You're exactly right. Negotiation is not possible with people like this, and you can't believe anything they tell you. And whatever they tell you, they'll change it the next day. So what I'm hoping is that a combination of military might plus economic starvation around when they produce oil now, it goes into storage. I'm told their storage facilities are going to be full in a week, and then they're going to have to start dismantling their oil wells, which I'm told is a nightmare, because once you dismantle an oil well, it's very hard to get it to produce again. So they're in a real quandary. So what I'm hoping is that the military regime is so weakened that there's revolts in some of the 31 provinces of Iran. And one by one, the people in those different provinces take over their province with American help and Israeli help, by the way, and until finally it becomes a movement to take over the country. So that's what I'm hoping happens.
Well, that's interesting to see if that can even take place, because that's another question I had here, internal uprisings. The IRGC, this regime, they have so much blood on their hands. I don't know that anything going forward that has any remnant of them is going to be satisfactory to the world. Will it? Would it be?
No, think of it. We're in what I call World War III, and it's a repeat of World War II. So did we spend a lot of time negotiating with Hitler? No. Or with the Japanese Imperial Army? No. So we just realized we're in a fight to the finish, and either we win or they win, and we won. So to me, this is a repeat, and we just have to persevere and win. The trouble is, democracies don't have the patience today that they had in our parents' or grandparents' generation. You know, everyone wants instant gratification. Okay, you know, the ball game's over, let's go home, you know, type of stuff. And so we've only been fighting like 50 days, which in the history of warfare is like nothing.
Yeah.
But the reality is being the way it is. We have midterms coming up, and I think President Trump wants some sort of a victory in the next month or two so that he can focus on more mundane issues that are relevant for the election coming up in November.
Trying to put the pieces together, we're obviously witnessing an Iranian, Israel, and American conflict in Iran there too. But there are a lot of different players on the stage here. I mean, you even go back to Maduro in Venezuela, Russia. It has a part in this conflict. China is a big part of this conflict. So there are a lot of pieces. And our president, I think, has been pretty strategic and had a pretty good soft touch about it. Our guest today referred to that as kind of zigzagging a little bit, and I get that. Kenneth Abramowitz is with us, founder of Save the West. That's simply SaveTheWest.com. A lot of good stuff on there. Right now, I'm just looking at it and peeling down through it. Regime change is the best option, part two. Ken's thoughts for the week. We will certainly want to get to that, Ken. And I thank you for being here, author of the book, The Multi-Front War, Defending America from Political Islam, China, Russia, Pandemics, and Racial Strife. Wow, yeah, we got a lot of enemies and frenemies, as he's saying. Let's take this call real quick and see where Nancy wants to go. She's always chiming in with some good thoughts. Nancy, you're on the air with author and analyst Ken Abramowitz.
Good morning, Tom, and thank you for taking my phone call. Good morning, Kenneth. Very complicated subject that we're speaking of. I want to talk mostly about the jihadists inside of our own country and how they are trying to destroy and influence Americans away from our Constitution and our principles, and they are seem to be getting a lot of support from the Democrat Socialist Party. I want to talk first about immigration, and then I have a question about capitalism, commerce, how they're competing. We're going to go to Dearborn, Michigan. Right now we have a birthright citizen. His name is Abdul El Said. His parents were in our country illegally from Turkey. She gave birth to Abdul as a young man. He still is a young man, but as a younger man, he went back to Turkey, and he is an extremist, a jihadist, and he is running for Senate right now in the state of Michigan. And I want to travel now to New York City. We're going to go visit the mayor there, another extremist who supports Hamas. And this would be, you know, the mayor, Mamdani. He's pushing these communist socialist grocery stores. They're a chain in the Middle East known as Aldi, capital A-L-D-I. And they're springing up all the way across our country, even in the country, in the state of Arkansas. One has just opened up in Dearborn, Michigan. Now, the problem with these is that they are trying to compete with our national food chains, our grocery stores like Walmart or Albertsons and many others, Kroger's, the mom-and-pop operations. And they are filthy. They are understaffed. We don't know where these foods are coming from. I don't know how they can even operate. Where's the FDA?
Land the plane for us, Nancy. Land the plane. What's your question here? And
I want to know is how can we stop this? They're competing with our commerce. We don't need socialism grocery stores. I mean, we've got a food bank network. We've got grocery stores, a wonderful system. How can we stop this? Because we're going to have to subsidize this. Taxpayers are getting stuck. This is the threat in our country that I see right now.
And you addressed this. Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate that. Listening on the Mighty 790 KGHL. And you addressed that. It's kind of in part of the title of your book as well, Racial Strife. I mean, we're seeing a lot of players, not only on the military front, but the psychological warfare that's been going on here as well.
Well, I monitor seven forms of warfare. Most people think war is just kinetic. In other words, things blow up. But I monitor six other forms of warfare, and she got into a number of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's also chemical, biological weapons. There's also cultural warfare. That's when you fight with words. For example, you, me, everyone listening today, we're all cultural warriors. We fight with our words. Number four, you can fight with economics. For example, the supermarket chain is economic warfare by the government against the owners of supermarkets. You can fight with legal warfare. Number six would be demographics, bringing people in with a different culture, a non-Judeo-Christian culture into America. That's demographic warfare. And then you have cyber. So I monitor all seven forms of warfare, and the discussion from, I believe, Nancy was really isn't putting words in her mouth. There's an economic war going on with these supermarkets. Why do we allow that? And there's a demographic war with birthright citizenship, which should be illegal. Mm-hmm. That's demographic war. And how do we maintain our culture when we import people with a different culture? And the answer is we have to stop importing people with a different culture. And if they are here, we have to force them to abide by our culture. Otherwise, they're going to force us to abide by their culture. So I'll give you an example. When public officials swear in, they swear in a ceremony on a Bible. Now there's a trend to swear in on the Quran. The Quran's not Judeo-Christian. It's not part of our culture. You can't swear in on the Quran. That's one issue. Number two, if you're Muslim, you have to accept the Constitutional Bill of Rights. That's our legal code. You can't say, I believe in Sharia law from the 7th century desert and say, oh, here it is, 1,400 years later. You have to accept that. No, we don't have to accept that. And I think all candidates for public office should pass national security clearances, which we don't right now force them to do so. So there's a number of changes we have to make in order to save our culture, and we're not making them. And that's why I'm worried, and that's why I wrote my book, and that's why I have my website, and that's why I give 100 speeches a year, and that's why I'm on the radio or TV 100 times a year, because I'm trying to wake up the society that we have a Judeo-Christian culture that we should be very proud of, and we have a right to protect it.
Are they listening?
but they're listening too late. In other words, they listen when there's a disaster. By the way, that's human nature.
Yeah, right.
People listen when there's it's like an alarm clock. You know, I want to sleep. Oh, there's an alarm clock. Oh, I guess I better wake up. So you could say I'm a little alarm clock, you know, and you're a little alarm clock. But we need a lot of us because we're all little alarm clocks, so to speak, and we need help.
I've got less than a minute here. And Nancy's comments spurred a question about all those terrorist organizations, those cells that you believe are in America in large numbers, right?
Well, there's two types. There's more, but just pretend there's two types of terrorists. There's a physical terrorist, in other words, a gun, a bomb, which we have the FBI and police to examine and go after. But there's cultural terrorists who fight with words. We don't know how to handle cultural terrorists. So my argument is anyone who incites genocide against Americans, against Christians, against Jews, should be outlawed, arrested, and if relevant, deported. We should not tolerate incitement to genocide. That's where I draw the line, free speech. That's cultural warfare.
Thank you. We're going to have to take some hard steps, and this country does not like hard steps. Thanks for coming alongside today. We're looking at all the pieces to a bigger puzzle, the Iranian conflict. Kenneth Abramowitz is with us here today. Citizens for National Security. He's the chairman of that organization. That's CFNS.org. A lot of good information there. Also, the one that I got turned on to, and I like this one, Save the West. It's SaveTheWest.com, which Kenneth is the founder of. And then also we're talking about, has some chops in healthcare and finance, some major chops there too, but got on to study in national security and then wound up writing this book, The Multi-Front War. There's a subtitle, Defending America from Political Islam, China, Russia, Pandemics, and Racial Strife. It seems like there's a lot of things coming at us, Ken. Thanks for coming on the program today. I appreciate that. Kind of going back to where Nancy was about how many terror groups or terror cells. We're worried about these little terror cells, right, that are planting bombs for some summer event that we plan on going to. So that's what we're aware of. But I heard in an interview that you did, when you talked about getting to some bottom lines here and accomplishing this Iranian conflict, one of them was the financing angle of it, and you noted there that it's global. There are 600,000, as you noted, are these terrorists individually? And there's more than just physical terror, too. So go into that, please.
Yes, Iran has created the largest terror organization in the world with approximately, well, let's say at least 600,000 worldwide terrorists. Now, about 300,000 are physical terrorists, like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So, by the way, Al-Qaeda and ISIS at their peak were 30, 40,000. So Iran's almost 10 times the size in terms of physical terrorists as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And by the way, we didn't negotiate with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We just said we have to destroy them. So they have 300,000 physical terrorists, plus they have 100,000 narco-terrorists. So they could be people who sort of look like us or bankers, but they're moving money around, they're moving drugs around, and about 100,000 Americans die every year to illicit drugs. So they're part of the process of killing 100,000 members of our society every year. That's narco-terrorists, primarily through Latin America and up over the border and into America. And then they have 200,000, what I call cultural terrorists. Now, cultural terrorists don't kill anyone directly, but they could be a teacher, a imam in a mosque. They could be a writer of a book. They could be on media, social media, and there, or they could be influencers. They could be TV, radio. So these cultural terrorists, which are largely in Latin America and Africa, are creating the next generation of physical terrorists. So if you teach a six-year-old and then a 10-year-old how to hate Christians, Jews, and Hindus, and say that Christians, Jews, and Hindus have no right to exist, and then when they're 18, they now hate Christians, Jews, and Hindus, and you give them a gun and say, kill a Christian, Jew, or Hindu, they go, of course. You know, for the last, ever since I was 5 years old, you told me that how evil Christian, Jews, and Hindus. By the way, I never met a Christian, Jew, or Hindu. It doesn't matter. You told me they were evil. As soon as I find a Christian, Jew, or Hindu, I'm going to kill them. So you see how cultural terrorists breed the next generation of physical terrorists. So we have to go after cultural terrorists as well as physical terrorists.
And the narco-terrorists as well, as you noted. That's,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and the narco-terrorists and the physical terrorists. You have to do all of the above. The way I look at life is when you're fighting a terror organization, which uses many different techniques, you have to fight them on every single front, every single capability, every single country, every minute of the day. You can't fall asleep anywhere.
Yes, and I don't see this president doing that. I think he's got a handle on it. But yeah, you had noted in that interview I saw that it was never a good idea to move deadlines. Trump did move a deadline here. And again, maybe that's the zigging and zagging. I feel it does take kind of a soft touch in all of this. Do you think that President Trump wants the Iranians to believe that there's an end to this that keeps them in power just to buy the time? Or, I mean, so that they don't get so desperate that they use these, you know, nuclear weapons that they may have or may not have. I mean, what's your thought on that? Is Trump playing this right to maybe keep them thinking they're in the game, but ultimately working toward that regime change?
Yes, I think you're getting to a very important point. I think Trump's trying to do both at the same time. He's remember, every time a president opens his mouth, he's talking to many different audiences. So, for example, he's talking to the regime, of course, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and sort of implying that they can stay in power. But he's also speaking to the Iranian people, 85% of whom hate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and offering hope that there'll be a new government and they'll be free of the monsters who run the government to today. So, yes, he's speaking to both at the same time, just as he's also speaking to Americans, obviously. He's speaking to Republicans. He's speaking to Democrats. He's speaking to our sort of allies in Europe. So it's not easy being the president of the United States because you have such a big microphone that everyone's listening to every word you have to say. But, yes, he's in effect saying to the Islamic Revolutionary Guards is you can stay in power if you surrender to 10 American demands, to which their response is, I'm not surrendering to the 10 demands and I'm staying in power. I'm not taking the deal. And that's the dilemma that President Trump faces.
Let's connect some dots. China, Venezuela, the Iranian ghost fleet, the oil supply. China's GDP was at like 5% projected. It's been dribbled back a little bit. So has America's for that matter. Connect those dots as how all of this is involved in the Middle East. I know. Well, yeah, and do it like, 30 seconds or less, right? Yeah, that could take some time.
Okay. There's three groups of bad guys in the world. There's the communists, China, Russia, North Korea, the Islamists, Iran, Qatar, and the globalists, United Nations, World Economic Forum, the drug cartels. I color code these bad guys, the reds, the greens, and the blues, to make it easy to remember. So the reds, the greens, and the blues are all working together. So, and China's fingerprints loom large behind the reds, the greens, and the blues. So China is in effect saying to Russia, keep fighting in Ukraine till the cows come home. And they're telling the Iranians, keep fighting America and Israel till the cows come home. And they're telling themselves, we're going to keep fighting Taiwan till the cows come home, because we have plenty of time. We're a dictatorship. We don't have elections coming up. Whereas the we in the West, we say, wait a minute, there's an election, midterms coming up in November. I want a solution to this or that. Let's tie this together. But the bad guys don't want us to win midterms. They don't want us to win elections. They basically want to wear us down by just saying no, no, no. Whatever you want, the answer is no. Ukraine wants the following 10 things, the answer is no. America and Israel want 10 things, the answer is no. Taiwan wants 10 things, the answer is no. But by the way, they told Maduro in Venezuela, fight till the end. Yeah, he fought till the end, but he got captured along the way. And they're probably encouraging Cuba to fight till the end, but their days are numbered too. So we have to, and President Trump's doing a good job at this, we have to navigate between the demands of a democracy and the demands of a dictatorship simultaneously and win wars and get reelected. It's a real trick, and not many people can do it, and President Trump's one of the few capable of doing it.
Are they building, I know they are working on it, but record pace, a pipeline that actually cuts across, what is that country that's part of the Strait of Hormuz? The idea there is to not rely on the Strait of Hormuz. There have been some work on that over the years. So Hormuz, will that continue to be an oil choke point opportunity for Iran? Or after it's all said and done, are we going to avoid that tangle in our chain supply?
Well, all of the above. So Saudi Arabia already planned ahead and built a pipeline from the east of Saudi Arabia to the west of Saudi Arabia, so they bypassed the Strait of Hormuz, but they haven't bypassed the Red Sea leading to the Suez Canal, so which is controlled by the Houthis, who are part of the Iranian terror organization. They're part of the 300,000 physical terrorists that Iran has. So it's a quandary here, because there's two big choke points that Iran right now controls the Suez choke point. They lost control over the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump has to make sure that America's in charge and in control of both choke points. We can't allow terror organizations to take control anymore of these choke points and basically hold us hostage every single day. And so that's something that's not negotiable. Iran cannot be trusted anymore with control over the Strait of Hormuz or control over the gateway into the Suez Canal.
We're looking at something much larger here today with Kenneth Abramowitz, founder of Save the West and also chairman of Citizens for National Security, SaveTheWest.com and CFNS.us for information there, author of The Multi-Front War. I feel like we got so much to cover here still, Kenneth, but I want to open it up to you. I got like 4 minutes here. What is it that we need to know? Kenneth, tell us, what the main thing is on your mind when you examine this conflict, the past and the future of it.
Okay, well, maybe this analogy will help people. There's 8 billion people in the world, and they all look like human beings. But many of them don't behave like human beings. Many of them behave like animals. So I have an expression, when a human being behaves like an animal, you should treat them like an animal. So the people running around are basically the equivalent of animals. So what do you mean? So pretend that an animal, a lion, tiger, bear, comes into your studio and speaks English and walks in and says, I'm hungry, you look like lunch, I'm going to eat you. You say, Mr. Lion, Tiger, or Bear, I'm going to call Domino's, I'll get you a pizza. What pizza do you want? It'll be here in 20 minutes. And the Lion, Tiger, Bear says, you didn't hear me. You're the lunch. So the point I'm getting to is animals think differently than humans. And so when you're dealing with animals like the people running around, not the people of around, the people of around are like us, but the terror structure running that those people are the equivalent of animals, and we have to treat them as animals. It doesn't sound nice, but that's basically the way it is.
And with that, you know, what we need to do then is be listening to the good guys, right? And so who are the good guys in this conflict?
Half the people in the world live in a democracy. Half live in a dictatorship. The dictatorships they call animals, not the people in the dictatorships. Mm. Yeah. The people are suffering, but the leadership of the dictatorships basically act like animals. So therefore, we, the democracies, have to work together and save ourselves from the dictatorships. And who are we? We're Judeo-Christian culture, mm-hmm. and plus India, they're the Hindus. So together, 2.5 billion Christians, a billion Hindus, and 16 million Jews have to work together, because we're a democracy. We're the democracies, and we have to save ourselves from the animals. Again, you know, I hate to say that, but to save ourselves from the animals running these dictatorships.
You you wrote this book, finished it in 2020, and you've already got 4 editions to it. This is the 4th edition. That kind of tells you how dynamic this is, right? I got about a minute left here, Ken. I want to ask you about the book, and you know, tell us about it.
Well, when people write books, when it comes time to writing the next book, they sit down and write the next book, well, obviously with a different title. And I said to myself, wait a minute, this multi-front war is going on and on and on. So why don't I just keep the book as is and just add a chapter, a second edition, do it again, third edition, do it again, fourth edition. So that's the book, you could say, has been written over a 5-year period of time. But when people buy the book, they should go right away to the last chapter, which is called Trump 2.0, and read the most recent update. And then if they have time, they can go back into the past and read the earlier versions of the book.
30 seconds. Are we going to take the necessary steps?
I'll say yes.
Okay, me too.
By the way, it can go either way. But it's Americans do not like war, but they particularly don't like presidents who lose war. So I think President Trump understands he's got to win the war with Iran. Prime Minister Netanyahu knows he has to win the war with Iran. Basically, America and Israel have a joint venture, unofficial joint venture,
to
save Western civilization.
Got to leave it there. Kenneth Abramowitz. Thank you, Kenneth. Appreciate it. Be well, sir.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.